Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Stephen Price, author of By Gaslight, published last month by FSG. Stephen's the author of two award-winning poetry collections, Anatomy of Keys and Omens in the Year of the Ox. His first novel was Into That Darkness. By Gaslight is a novel, a lengthy novel, that delves into the hearts and minds of two men, William Pinkerton and Adam Foole, and a third, a kind of will-o'-the-wisp Edward Shade, a wraith that draws the two unlikely bedfellows, Pinkerton and Foole, together. So we're kind of transported throughout the novel through space and time, much like we are in our own lives, but in a fashion that evokes, like the smell of autumn leaves or the lingering knee-level fog of London, the colors of a gaslit street, the soot covering a railing in a bleary neighborhood. The book bathes us in the poetic light of a railroad car or a hotel room, a suit of clothes, or even a silver-tipped cane. And they're all rendered so vividly that one is not sure of whether we create the image as the reader or did the author. So taken as a piece, By Gaslight transports us to a world we hadn't really encountered before, except through perhaps Dickens. A world doesn't exist today, but one which we both long for and are kind of in terror of as we live our workaday life tweeting and shooting selfies. So with that, welcome, Stephen, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I love covers and epigraphs, and your cover is so cool, whether you picked it or not. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because it really sets the book up well.
Yes. It was designed by Kelly Hill, who's one of the in-house art designers here in Canada with McLellan Stewart, which is my Canadian publisher. And then when FSG purchased the image, they adjusted it and darkened it and made it moodier.
Yeah, and it really is. It kind of almost—it's almost like you're walking into the novel. It's a really good job, and a lot of the reviewers have said that too. But like with the epigraphs, I'm normally expecting something by Dostoevsky or something by Kafka or whoever, and yours are very good, but they're epigraphs that are penned by the protagonist of the novel. How did you come about that fashion of doing it?
Well, I'm so glad you noticed. The epigraphs. There's three that are attributed first to Adam Foole, and then there's one that's attributed to William Pinkerton. And Adam Foole, of course, is a fictional character. He's completely made up, but William Pinkerton really lived, and he was a real person. And the novel, in some strange way, became this sort of exploration of the idea of truth and lies in historical fiction, because one of my main characters was real. I wanted to keep him as accurate as I could, and the other one was made up. And every time the two of them came into contact with each other, of course, any historical truthfulness vanished. It instantly became invention. And the epigraphs are kind of this play on that themselves. Adam Foole's epigraphs, of course, are entirely fictional. But the William Pinkerton epigraph, which he says, I really and truly think I can handle this man. I can make him useful to us. That's taken from an actual letter that William Pinkerton was writing to his brother, Robert, in which he was talking about an elusive criminal that roughly sort of inspired the idea of Adam Foole.
It's funny how you handle it so well in your note at the end where you say, there are plenty of nonfiction books about the Pinkerton Agency. This is not one of them. And I think it goes right to what you were just saying, but from the reviews of the books, from the book also, I think I know the answer to this question. But why Pinkerton? Why choose the Pinkerton Agency, which has all kinds of nuance? And you know, I remember from reading about it when I was a kid, and also the Strikebreaker Pinkerton Agency. So how did you decide that?
Well. You know, I knew very little about the Pinkerton Agency when I started writing this book. The the book itself, I'd read a biography of William Pinkerton some years before I ever sat down and wrote anything on this. And I was in the middle of a different novel, and I sat down one day to write, and I wrote a paragraph, which was a character sketch of William Pinkerton, presumably based loosely on this book I'd read some years before. And that became the first paragraph in the book, and I kept it, and it's still there. I only changed one word. And that was kind of a surprise to me, but the character was so compelling. And I think what interested me, I mean, this novel is set in 1885, so it's prior to the dramatic strike breaking that was happening that gave the Pinkertons a very bad name. Fraught and complicated public image. But the idea that this agency was started by a single figure, Alan Pinkerton, William's father, seems kind of innocent and elegant to me as a storyteller, because it's this single person who could establish this dynasty, this person who would cast a very long shadow. And then, of course, William, being the oldest son, grows up in that shadow and has to deal with his father's presence. And then when his father dies in 1884, significantly his father's absence, because for the first time, finally, he's living in the world without his father, and he's taking over in some ways this role that his father had invented. And the idea of fathers and sons was very important to me, parents and children, in this particular book.
Yeah, I mean, I know exactly, and you talk about it, it's almost like a haunting relationship in a way, but I'm the eldest son, my father was way, way, way larger than life. So all my life, it's been a question of, well, do I compare myself to him? Do I try to be better than him? Or do I live my own life? And I think there's that. And I think you've talked about it a little bit in your interviews about the fact that it's kind of a haunted relationship, and it's got all kinds of things mixed up in it, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, it really does. You know, during the writing of this novel, we here at home, we had two kids. So I myself was going through this great change in my life, where I was moving from being the child of my parents to being also the parent of my children. And I think this was working its way into the book everywhere. This question of who are you, and how do you figure out who you are in relation to these people, this family you're born into, as opposed to the family you choose. The family you choose being, of course, your partner, whoever you if you end up having a partner and spending your life with someone. But the family you're born into, and of course your children too. You don't get to pick your children; they're born with personalities, and they're sort of this gift that's bestowed on you. So I think William's wrestling with all of this stuff throughout the book.
Do you ever do like I do, which is like think, I wonder what Dad would do, or like I sound just like my dad, or something like that.
Oh my goodness! So often now, especially my jokes, these terrible dad jokes that keep coming out.
Well, now that I'm older, when I get out of a chair, I make the same sounds my dad used to make when he got out of a chair, and that's really irritating. Well, so do we all have Edward shades in our lives? That's another question I thought about, because I kind of do.
Well, that's a good question. You know, I don't know. I mean, Edward Shade was an obsession of William's father. And when William's father dies, William decides, of course, to try to find this man and finish his father's unfinished business. I think there must be something that plays that role for us, all of us. And, you know, when I think of Edward Shade, what I'm really thinking of is the ability to get to know your parents on the terms in which they lived, who they were when they weren't being your parents. Who was your dad when you weren't around? What would it have been like if you had met him as a young man before you were born? What would he have been like? How would he have been different? I think William is trying to figure that out about his father. He was such a larger-than-life figure. And what he wants to do, I think, in some way, is understand what he was as a person, as opposed to a father.
You know, and I don't want to give any spoilers away because there's so many of them, but like at the very beginning, so it's not a spoiler, just the idea that when he is able to get a hold of his father's documents, in a very concrete way. It's almost like he's getting a hold of, like you were just saying, like a portion of his dad. Like, here's what he wrote. And I think he feels like more than just a basic picking up papers or some kind of kinship there almost. And I think that's kind of where the poetic aspect of things comes into play, at least to me.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. I think so.
And the other thing that's really funny is, you know, Pinkerton, William is such this, you know, like one reviewer said, his knuckles never really heal up. But he's such a big guy, not like Flood, but big, and so imposing and scares everybody off. But then what's so funny, and it took me a while to reconcile it, is like when he goes over to Charlotte's house after she's whatever, and the birdcage is empty, and the constable is there. And the constable is doing all these plays on words about canaries and jailbirds and just took them on a lark. And Pinkerton seems to be, he says, "You can stop whenever you want, constable." But it's like, I didn't think he had a sense of humor, and it doesn't seem like he would have a sense of humor, but he has this very, you know what I mean? It just...
Yeah, you know, I like to think that he had a grim appreciation for humor, but he certainly, you know, he's got his eye on the finish line down the road, and he's sort of very soberly moving towards that.
But there is a human side to him, a nice, almost kind of a nice human side.
Yeah, you know, he's also constantly thinking about his absent wife, of course, or
right.
His wife who's back in Chicago, and he's of course absent. But you know, he's constantly thinking about her, and he's thinking about what she might think about what he's up to. She's this important sounding board for him, Margaret. And that was a conversation that I was having with my editors, on and on about this question of what kind of a role could Margaret have in his life if it's the 1880s and this is William Pinkerton. I mean, you know, who could she have been to him, and what would have been plausible for these characters in this time? But they met when they were very young, and they married young, and they stayed together their whole lives, and there's no hint of any sort of infidelity on William's part. Unlike his father, Alan, where there's some speculation that there was quite a notorious affair that was carried on sort of under William's mother's nose. And I kept thinking that surely would have marked him as a young boy and as a young man, and of course as an older man, as something that would have caused pain to someone he loved and something that he would never have wanted to fall into or be party to.
But if you're looking at the book from the very beginning, when you first learn that he doesn't spend nearly as much time, if any, with his wife and child, it's almost as if he's like totally neglected them, right?
Right. But he's also a guy who
but he loves them.
Hasn't been at home. Yeah. I know. He's somebody who travels for his business, and he travels. It's a hands-on business, and he's away an awful lot. And is he away because he doesn't want to be there, or is he away because he wants to be there so much that it matters so much to him that he's a little afraid to be present? I think all these things are, hopefully all these things are playing into his character.
I think so. He's a man with priorities, and, you know, it's a question of whether that first priority is a logical one.
Yeah.
But I do think it's something that a lot of people do carry around. And I don't mean that everybody has an obsession with something, but everybody does have a list of priorities, and some people are considered good because of their list of priorities, and some people aren't. But
yeah. Well, I hope underneath all of that part of what shines through in William's character is, deep under it is this compassion. Because as a historical figure, he struck me as somebody who he was very rough, very capable, and very work obsessed. But there was also this degree of forgiveness and compassion and this faith that bad people could find their way and walk in a good life. Some of his longest lasting friendships were with criminals. He preferred criminals to, for instance, lawmen, who often were quite corrupt back then. He would, in his off hours, he would go down and drink at the Underworld Saloon in Chicago, and then the next morning he would go back to work and try to catch the guys he'd been drinking with the night before. And then he would often catch them and send them to jail. But when those people came out of jail, they would go to William Pinkerton, and he would lend them money, and he would write them letters of introduction so that they could get work. And hopefully go straight.
You know, since it's such an epic novel, I wondered throughout whether when you wrote it, you considered any of these characters as heroes. Because in an epic novel, you generally do have heroes.
No. No, I don't think of them as heroes, and I also don't think of any of them as villains.
Really?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's people being people, and everybody has a capacity for good and evil, and that's part of what is frightening. You know, the way I was thinking about it, and this is sort of something that you're fumbling towards when you're writing a book, but later it starts to make some sense and you start to see it more clearly. But William Pinkerton is somebody for whom the ends justify the means. In his case, the ends are presumably lawful ones. Adam Fool, the other character in the book, is somebody for whom the ends can never justify the means. The means have to be correct. And he has a very strict moral and ethical code for the kind of life that he lives. He doesn't believe in violence, for instance. He's very loyal, and so on. And I think he believes that that goodness is possible in the people around him. And I think William is somebody who looks around him, and he's always thinking there might be a flaw there.
Yeah,
evil is possible in the people around me.
Well, that's the key to it, I think, is that, you know, they're two completely different characters with two moral codes. I don't necessarily agree with either of them, but then you throw them together, which is, you know, the crux of what happens in the book. And what was your first inkling that, hey, you know what I'm going to do? They're going to be integral to each other, and they may not want to proceed the way the other one wants to proceed, but it's going to be something that's going to be shared.
Well, you know, I thought the moment when the two men meet, these two characters, Adam and William, and I want to be careful about how I say it, because I wouldn't want to offer spoilers. It's a book that has so many twists and turns. But that moment was a moment that moved around in the book, sometimes closer to the beginning, sometimes farther away, deeper into the novel than it ended up. Because it's such a catalyst, it's this important moment, and it changes the nature of the novel, what the novel is looking for, the novel itself. So that was something that required a lot of
Did it just come to you that this is what was going to happen? Did you, you know, like full blown, did it say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do this. Or I know, well, that's a silly question, I guess, but
no, you know, it's really not. I'm somebody, I'm sure every writer's different, but I'm a writer who can't seem to write a novel without having some idea of what the form of that novel is, and how the form plays into one of the basic ideas of what the book is about. And I sort of need that in order to write the book. Everything else I might not have any idea about. So for this book, I couldn't sit down and actually get going on it until I had realized that I wanted to write a kind of a dual biography, where each alternating chapter, either one chapter was William and the next chapter was Adam, and the next chapter was William and then Adam. And I sort of, because I had that form, I also understood that if the two characters never met, these chapters would just be running in parallel to each other
right
across the course of the book.
Yeah, it's funny because you know, initially, a lot of people like, well, it's like books with lengthy family trees in them. People look at the family tree and they go, oh, no, I don't know. I'm going to have to flip back and forth like 100 Years of Solitude or something like that. And it's daunting. And then when you see a book where you know that it's going to be one chapter about this guy, one chapter about this guy, but then it melds so nicely together that you're kind of relieved that, oh, no, I'm going to have to learn something else before I can get to the next thing. And it's nice that they weave so seamlessly together, I think.
Thank you.
So how, you know, one, here's three words that affected me in the novel. It's very early on. It's in chapter two. You begin chapter two by saying, here is another. And I'm thinking those words aren't really necessary, but then I thought, well, they are. And I was thinking, does this mean that I'm going to be looking at a series of sketches, of paintings, of poems? But I don't know whether you said here is another as if introducing.
Yeah, you know, a very strange thing was happening at the front end of the book when I was writing the book, and it had to do with the voice. There's sort of this flattening out. It was almost,
yeah,
it was almost this noirish voice, and it only happens really early on in the book, and it only happens in a couple of places. Such as, I mean, a couple of brief sentences, and they usually stand alone. So on the very first page, there's a paragraph description of William Pinkerton, and then there's a moment where there's a paragraph that just says, so. And that's another place where it's almost as if the voice is pulling away from the character, gathering itself, and then moving back in. And here's another one of those lines. There's another line, a paragraph down that says, go on.
Yeah, it's
prompting
like
prompting the book to get going.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, for a second I thought, okay, the fourth wall is coming down in this book, and there's going to be somebody telling you you're reading it. But it never really happened. It was just...
Yeah, the fourth wall doesn't quite come down. But, you know, with third person, it's kind of wonderful because you can drift above the head and then move very closely down towards the head of your character, the skull of your character, and virtually be within their thoughts, and then pull back up. There's a lot of movement that you can do. And that was sort of these moments are the moments where it's pulled almost as high up as you can possibly get.
Yeah, and then there's always the problem of thinking, especially at the beginning, well, is this a reliable narrator I'm listening to? You know? Is this what really happened? But then that is resolved right away, and he is reliable. It's just like sometimes it's kind of nice to think, oh, I'm going to have to do a lot of work. I'm going to have to figure out this. Speaking of which, how did you come up with the names? Because, again, a lot of the reviews compare it to Anthony Trollope or Dickens because the names are so cool in there. Did you have to think about them, or did you just, okay, this is going to be Flood?
Well, you know, the characters on the William Pinkerton side of the story, those are all real people. They really lived. John Shore really lived, and so on. I think the only invented character was Inspector Blackwell. And sometimes the reviewers have commented on names and you know, praised the book for inventing names of people who really lived. And I think part of what people are responding to is there's this wonderful Victorian English name, this kind of style of name that I don't know if it's been smoothed out or if it's still there but just kind of underground and hiding on us, but you see it in all sorts of fiction from the time. And Trollope, of course, was so very different from Dickens, but they, you know, they had these names. The Adam Fool side of the story, those characters are all, of course, invented, and those names I had to come up with. They were very difficult, those ones. Fool was a very hard name to find. Yeah. But, you know, it's this funny thing where when you're writing a character and you don't have the right name, you can feel it. Something feels wrong. And if you ever find the right name, you know, it's suddenly it's like the shoe fits. It's quite wonderful.
I know. It's funny with my youngest daughter, who we adopted from China, her name was going to be Emily. And she was definitely going to be Emily. We decided. And then as soon as I saw her, I said, no, her name is Annie. And it was just like, it was just a split second. And if it was Emily, it would have been the wrong name. And Annie is exactly what she is. And like my other daughter goes, Annie is Annie. And that's what we always say. And it's just so funny how, you know, that's really true, isn't it?
It's so true. Yeah, we had the same thing with our daughter. We thought she was going to be an Isabel. We were sure she was going to be an Isabel. And then the moment she was born, she was so clearly not an Isabel that weeks went by where she was just called Baby Price because we couldn't find the right name, but we knew the one we thought was right wasn't right.
So did you come up with one that was right?
We think so, yeah. We think we did.
Well, sometimes I solve it in a very silly way, but it works. Like I have chickens, and every year I end up getting new ones because either the fox gets them or something happens. But there's one that's like a champion, and he's hung on for 5 years. So now we just call him Original Chicken. And we have cats, and there's this new cat that came along, and he just kind of hangs around, and we feed him every day. So he's just called New Cat. So we have New Cat and Original Chicken, which I think would be a great children's book, except I can't write.
That would be so great. I love Original Chicken.
So we talked a little bit before the interview about poetry, and, you know, I'm sure it's a question you get asked all the time, but I assume you'll return to poetry at some time, unless you're done with it. But I assume you will, right?
Yeah. I mean, not even when I'm done with fiction. I sort of have been doing these. They've both been present, sort of always. When I'm in the middle of writing one, say a collection of poems, I can't write fiction, and vice versa. But you know, my first book was poetry, my second book was a novel, my third book was poetry, and then By Gaslight is my fourth book, which of course is a novel. So in theory, my next book should be poetry, but it hasn't been planned, so I'm not really sure. But I haven't abandoned it.
It was funny. I got the new issue of The New Yorker while I was reading this book, and I was just leafing through it, looking at the cartoons, and there was a poem, but it wasn't really a poem. It was a paragraph, but they had it as a poem, and the paragraph reminded me so much of, like you describing the train car when Molly and Flood and Fool are sitting together in the train car, and I realized, you know, this is poetry because I'm able to read it, but get out of it more than what's in the words. And I interviewed this guy named Arturo Perez Reverte, and he would describe a guy getting dressed, and he'd get dressed in this beautiful suit, and then he'd have his boutonniere, and he'd have a handkerchief, and he'd have his pocket watch, and he'd have his cigar and cigar cutter. And it was like amazing because you could see everything perfectly. So I said, how can you do this? And he goes, I don't do it, you do it. And I thought that was the greatest answer.
Well, you know, sometimes people forget how much work the reader does. And you know, as writers, I think we're very sensitive to it and appreciative of it, that it's such a collaborative process. But it's almost this invisible thing, almost impossible to measure. Yeah, so I think that's one of the reasons people don't talk about it very much.
Well, and that's why I was asking questions about a poet who's a novelist or vice versa, because the novel is, you know, assumed by this poetry, and it seems like it would take so long. I mean, it just seems like it would be, unless the words just flow out. That's why I asked whether one's informed by the other, because it seems like they must be, but it also seems like it would take an enormous amount of time. Which brings me to the question, was the book originally, did you have to cut the book? Because it's 742 or whatever pages.
Yeah. Well, when I sat down to begin editing, the editing process took about 13 months.
Yikes.
It was quite intensive. And when we sat down to work on the book, we ended up cutting, I think, about 35,000 words.
Wow.
But then we ended up adding 65,000 words. So the book got bigger, even though it was getting tighter.
That's odd. That's unusual.
Yeah, it was very strange. And I think both my editor and myself, we wanted the book to be tight. So there was a lot of bagginess that we thought we could cut. But then we also could see these enormous gaps, absences in the book, places where the book if it was moving horizontally, places where we felt it could sort of plunge through vertically and deepen and enrich the book. And that's, I think, where all the new material came in.
Wow. It's almost like you're doing some kind of Venn diagram or something. It's funny because I own an independent bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop, and, you know, some reviews, oh, it's too long. Some reviews say it's, you know, it's an epic, like War and Peace or something like that. And I'm looking at it sitting there now on our bestsellers list book table, and there it is in the middle. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, I wonder if people are going to look at this and think, oh, that's too big, or, you know, instead, based on the sales, it seems to me like they look at it and they go, wow, that's going to be really cool, because it sits, you know, it sits like an inch above all the other books. And my daughter Annie, again, she took it and she went around the bookstore saying, I want to see if I can find a book that's as thick as this book. She put it next to all the light that we can, all the light we can see. And she goes, nope. It's about half the size.
Oh, that's funny.
Well, since you're talking about the work of the reader, you know, I could ask you what life lessons a reader can take from this, but did you have a concept? First of all, did you, when you gave it away, when you gave your book, your first, your child to the universe, to your readers, did you feel like, I'm letting go of this, I can't let go of it, or I feel bad letting go of it? Did you have any of those kind of... Because some authors tell me they do.
Well, you know, I mean, having two young children right now, I certainly don't think of... I know some writers do. I don't think of my books as my children. Right. It's a project, a world, a story, and especially for me, always the characters who come first is... It's something I've been living alongside and inside of for many years. But by the time it's ready to go, when the editing and the copy editing and everything's done and it's been set, I think I'm ready for a rest.
Okay.
I think I'd feel differently if I felt that the editing had been rushed or I didn't have a chance to do things I wanted to do. But it certainly wasn't that way with Gaslight.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's you gave thanks to a lot of people, but it's definitely clear that you owe it, because for 13 months, I imagine someone beside you is working really hard to make this thing come out right.
Oh my goodness, I've had such wonderful people working on the book. I've been really, really lucky in that regard, and you know, I feel grateful every day about it. And at the back of the book, there's an extended acknowledgement page. And you know, I'm just as a writer, I'm kind of a cranky writer in that I like acknowledgments to stay brief. But there were so many people who were so helpful and so integral to this book and getting it out there that the acknowledgments page got kind of, I wouldn't say too long, but it's long.
No, it was very understandable and it was very nice actually. But it's funny because we were talking about, I guess the work of the reader, but you know, it really is a lot of work for the reader, because you're going down these alleys. You don't know whether it's going to come out somewhere else. And you're traveling, as I said earlier, through space and time to places and times you didn't think you'd be going. So it really is a lot of work to keep straight, and it's doable. It's certainly doable and it's fun doing it, but don't you think you have given the reader, you know, not homework, but don't you think you've given the reader a task as well?
Well, I guess so. I mean, I hope that the book is I wanted to write, this will sound crazy, I wanted to write a book that was a page turner, that was compulsively readable, that was propulsive. And at the same time, I wanted to write a book, at exactly the same time, I wanted to write a book that was digressive, like a really wonderful Dickensian novel. And the two things, of course, don't live happily together. So it was kind of a crazy thing that I was setting out to do. But, you know, I think in the digressions, for me as a reader, that's where a lot of the pleasure lies. Those little moments that really have nothing to do with moving a story forward, but they reveal a wonderful aspect of a character or the feel of lived life, you know, that sort of messiness. And I was looking for that effect and that feel, especially because I was conscious of the fact that I was building a world. I was building a time that nobody who's alive today ever saw. So this doesn't exist in living memory anymore. This is the 1880s in Victorian London, the 1860s of the Civil War, the American Civil War, in the 1870s with the South African Diamond Rush, and so on and on and on. So I was conscious of the fact that there's pleasure to be had, just like if you're visiting a city you haven't been in, there's pleasure to be had in moving a little bit aimlessly or taking the roundabout route. If you want to go to the museum, you could go there directly as fast as you can, or you could take some side streets and see what you can see of the city as you move there. And I sort of had that feeling as I was writing the book. But at the same time, I wanted the book to move, and I wanted it to have some legs because it was so big. So I wanted the reader to have a reason to move forward into the book, and I kept finding that reason, oddly enough, didn't lay in the future, in what happens next, so much as what happened earlier, and trying to uncover this mystery of something that happened and what the exact truth of that was.
Well, it definitely was a page turner, and for this reader, it kind of makes me angry at you. Because, like, I have to get up in the morning, like, at 5:30 or 5:45 and get the kids ready and take them to the bus or take them directly to school. And so because it's a page turner, I'm staying up till, like, 3 o'clock in the morning, which really screws up my whole life.
Well, I'm sorry.
But it's a great thing. And well, now the other thing that's weird is now that I've gotten older, sometimes I'll fall asleep with the book on my chest. I wake up, and while I'm asleep, I'm dreaming the book. Except it's obviously a completely different book than you wrote. And then when I wake up, I'm going, wait a minute, where am I? Did this happen? And then I have to go back like 20 pages to get back to the real book.
Oh, wow. Wouldn't that be interesting? Wouldn't that be interesting to hear the dream book?
Yeah, it would. And again, if I could write, that's always struck me as being, you know, like the never-ending story or something like that, where, you know, you find, Sophie's World or something like that, where you find you're actually in the book, or that the dream you're having is a book that the author was meaning to write but never got around to. Yeah, I've always thought that. More so recently because now it actually happens. But yeah, it's definitely a page turner, and I think it is because the chapters, although dealing with different people, really meld together. You know, and then again, without spoiling it, increasingly as you go through the book. But I guess in conclusion and letting you go, I really, really enjoy it. I've recommended it to, so has my book manager too, because she loved it as well, my bookstore manager. So I've recommended it, and I'm just pleased that I got to talk to you today about it.
Oh, that's wonderful. Me too.
We were talking with Stephen Price about his new book, By Gaslight, which clocks in at a hefty 742 pages. But as we were talking about, first of all, he's a great poet. And whether you like poetry or not, it reads in such a way that you actually create a world. I don't mean like in like a Tolkien kind of sense, but in the sense of, you know, like warm light coming through a window in summertime, and you have this big fluffy duvet on a bed and it's kind of turned back, and you see the shadows, and you see a cat in the window, and it all just comes true. It all just is like magic. There it all is for you. And you have to have this certain type of talent with words to be able to accomplish such a task. So in any event, I'm very glad that I got to read the book, and I'm very glad that I got to interview him today. Upcoming guests. So this is completely different. This is this guy, Jonathan Tepperman. He is the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, and he's written this book called The Fix, How Nations Survive and Thrive in a World of Decline, a World in Decline. So what it is, it's about what a horrible world we live in, but here are these, and he has 10 different countries and 10 different things they're doing to make the world a better place. So while I take issue with, you know, the idea that these little tiny things necessarily make a better world, it's a very interesting read because places like Singapore or Indonesia or Canada or even Rwanda are doing things that are changing their countries for the better. So it's a really good reflection on the world view of this gentleman, and also on for us to take a look at our own country, especially given the times we've just been through, and reflect on how we can, in small ways and incremental ways, make our planet and our country better. And then lastly, we will be interviewing Dava Sobel, whose latest work is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Basically a book about how women never get any credit for scientific things when in actuality they do all the grunt work. And she's a great author. She wrote Galileo's Daughter and that book about the discovery of longitude. And I'm really looking forward to interviewing her, as well as the other authors we have lined up for us. So for a complete schedule, you can visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com or the WCHE website or Podomatic, or you can catch our broadcast almost as soon as they're done on iTunes, just, and in this case, by just typing in By Gaslight, or by typing in the name of the author, Stephen Price. So in any event, thanks so much for listening today, and we will hope that you'll be here next week to listen once again as we have another great author here on The Avid Reader.